conversation with queer identified writers about their works and lives. Welcome to Queer Words. This is Wayne Goodman, and on this episode, I have the delightful pleasure of conversing with Patrick E. Horrigan. Hey, Patrick.
Hi, Wayne.
Can we start by having you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself?
I have a background in academia. I got a PhD in English. I taught literature for about 30 years. I took early retirement from that so that I could focus full-time on writing. I'm also training to become a tour guide at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I'm originally from Reading, Pennsylvania, which is one of the four railroads on the Monopoly board.
This is Queer Words, and I do ask my guests, what qualifies you as queer?
I'm ambivalent about the word queer. It's not a word that I use to describe myself. I remember when the word came into prominence in the 1990s as a badge of honor. I understand why people embraced it then and still embrace it, to the extent that it has to do with inclusivity and resisting labels that are not helpful and opening up possibilities for people and their identities, then sure, I accept it and I embrace it. But for me, it's one of those words that's been repurposed and it still has an aroma of its history and where it came from. I identify myself as a gay man. I've known that I'm gay since I was a teenager. My work focuses on the LGBTQ world and lives. That's what qualifies me.
When did you first accept being queer?
It was a process. I started fearing that I was queer in high school in the late 70s. One important turning point for me, which I write about in my first book, which is called Widescreen Dreams, was seeing the movie Dog Day Afternoon with Al Pacino, where he plays this bisexual bank robber. But he's very sympathetic. I was very attracted to him as a 16-year-old. But it wasn't until I experienced giving and receiving love with another boy that I started to accept my queerness. That was in college. Not until I entered graduate school in the late 1980s and joined a gay men's study group at Columbia University, where I was surrounded by other gay guys, intellectuals, artists, activists, that I felt like I was plugging into a community and learning about the history of my community and starting to understand my place in a larger queer world. That's when I would say I finally came to accept myself. And by that time, I was in my mid-20s.
Who might some of your queer hero figures be?
One person that comes to mind is the artist Keith Haring, born in my hometown of Reading, PA, and went to art school initially in Kutztown, PA, and then came to New York, if he were still alive, a few years older than I am. I've always admired the fact that he was so phenomenally successful and yet managed to, as I perceive him, keep his feet on the ground. He seemed like a genuinely decent person. I say this based on having read his journals, which I think are absolutely wonderful. His commitment to social justice and people who were less advantaged than him comes through in his art and in the choices he made as an artist and as a business person. He was a hero in the sense that he got HIV and died of AIDS around the age of 30. That cohort of people who didn't make it are heroic in my eyes.
What about literary influences?
I gravitate toward that high modernist generation from the early 20th century. The person that I think of foremost is Virginia Woolf. I discovered Virginia Woolf in college. I was assigned Mrs. Dalloway in a literature course. I remember being so surprised to find a writer that seemed to speak my language and that I felt understood me in a way that I didn't know a writer could understand me. Her work has influenced mine in the sense that her work is driven by the psychology of her characters. The plot takes a back seat to what her characters are thinking and feeling. The major events of her novels are interior events. That's something that I try to do in my own fiction. There are many other things about her work that inspire me, but that's one thing. There are other writers of that generation like E.M. Forster and Marcel Proust and James Joyce, all of whom I love. I love their experiments with literary form. Again, that's something I try to do in my own fiction.
What inspired you to begin writing?
I was praised for my writing in school from a young age, and I always liked my English teachers. For many years, it had more to do with what other people were telling me about myself than what I thought about myself. like coming out, it was a process of self-discovery, becoming a writer. A big turning point for me was entering therapy in my early 20s. I started doing a lot of writing about all kinds of things. It poured out. I discovered that I enjoyed writing autobiography. My first book is a collection of autobiographical essays on film that I saw as a child. It's an attempt to reconstruct what I was thinking as a child watching these films, but from an adult perspective. I was starting therapy around the same time that I was starting graduate school, plugging into this very vibrant queer community in graduate school, and then all the writing that one does as a graduate student, that's when I started to realize I'm a writer.
How does queerness impact your writing?
In all kinds of ways. In terms of subject matter, whether it's memoir or fiction, I write about queer lives. I write about queer history. In terms of my literary approach, I also feel that it has an impact on that level. I feel a willingness to experiment and take certain kinds of risks that I don't know that I would do if I were not queer.
When it comes to writing process, do you like to start with an outline and work from that structure? Or do you sit down and type away, maybe something in the middle?
I tend to work with outlines. I like to know where I'm headed. It's very important for me to know the end point, and I work toward that. I work with outlines within outlines. I have a rough outline of the whole project, but then I'll have outlines of chapters and then sometimes outlines of scenes within chapters. Structure really interests me. Rhythm and pacing interests me. And I feel that having a firm grasp of the structure that I'm working within and the necessary and helpful limitations that structure imposes upon the writer, for me, that's all fruitful. Having a structure then allows me to take all kinds of chances and to go out on a limb. I often stray from my plan and I modify it as I go along. There's another thing that goes along with what I was saying about structure and outlines, which is I relate it in my head, although I'm not an actor, to method acting, where if I'm writing a scene and I have an idea of what happens in the scene, I try to have an idea of my character the way an actor would have an idea of his or her character in a scene. You have a lot more information about the character than maybe comes out in the script, but you bring all of that into the scene and it affects your motivation and how you relate to the other actors. I do some version of that with my characters where I get a handle on their biography, their childhood and their interests, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then I bring all of that into the scene that I'm working on. Sometimes I'll go off the rails and I'll go down some rabbit hole that I didn't know I wanted to go down, but I do. But I feel like I can do that knowing that there is a structure that's keeping me somewhat reined in.
Can you tell us a little bit about your body of work?
My first book was a memoir, as I mentioned, combination film theory and autobiography. I wrote that while I was taking my classes in graduate school. From an early stage in my development as a writer, I gravitated toward narrative. Then I decided to try my hand at fiction. I've published 3 novels. All of my work, whether it's the autobiographical work or the fiction work, each book revolves around some artistic medium that characters are in some kind of profound dialogue with in their lives. My memoir had to do with film. My first novel is about a guy in an art museum looking at portrait paintings. The whole thing takes place in about 1 hour in this exhibition. The novel after that is about an architect trying to save an old train station. My newest book, American Scholar, is about a writer who's doing research on a historic gay couple, and his life is mirroring this couple from generations past. All my work on some level is about art, and about art sounds like a funny phrase to use, but art appreciation, people who live their lives in relationship to some artistic medium.
If people are interested in reading your books, where can they find them?
Wherever books are sold. You can get them at Amazon. You can get them at my website, patrickehorrigan.com. You can get them at my publisher's website, lethepress.com. Order it from your local bricks and mortar bookstore if you don't see it on the shelf.
I hope you have some of your writing you can share with us.
I do. I'm going to read the first short chapter from my latest novel, American Scholar, published by Lethe Press. James Fitzgerald would no more part with those 12 storage boxes than cut off his right arm, for they contained all that was left of Gregory, in a material sense anyway. His files on lesbian and gay activism, articles on non-monogamy and queer theory, Marxism and feminism, his college notebooks, journals, essay drafts, old newspapers and magazines, flyers and pamphlets, song lists from his DJ days, everything to do with the gay study group at Columbia, not to mention record albums, cassette tapes, books, letters, items of clothing, his stash of political campaign buttons, a veritable time capsule of his life and the life they shared in New York in the 1980s. Every couple of months, Fran would mention the boxes, how they took up so much space in the spare room, how he wished they could turn it into a proper guest room, or maybe even a nursery. That was the real issue, not the boxes. The boxes weren't in anybody's way. The real issue was children. Fran wanted a child by the time he was 40, and the drumbeat had only gotten more insistent since he turned 38. James didn't want children. "My books are my children," he sometimes said. "Well, I'm sorry, but your books aren't enough for me," Fran would shoot back. They quarreled about it again this morning, and on the very day he was set to give a reading from American Scholar. Surely that was no coincidence. The buzz in the Warburg Lounge grew louder as the time approached. James had sequestered himself in the tiny office at the back of the lounge to look over his notes and some passages from the book. He never liked interacting with people before a talk or a class because it blew his concentration. Jay popped his head in. "You about ready, dollface?" James looked up, startled. "Sorry to disturb. Sandy said we should start in 5 minutes." "Almost ready." They briefly went over the plan for the reading and discussion. "So I just realized," Jay said, "I have more questions than we can possibly address, but I think some of what I want to get at during the interview will come up in Q&A with the audience." "That's fine. My part shouldn't take more than 20 minutes. I'll read a couple of passages, say a few words about Matheson, and the rest is up to you." "Sounds like a plan." James looked him in the eyes. "Thank you again for doing this. I appreciate it so much. Honey, what are friends for?" He held out his arms and they embraced. "You nervous?" "Always, but good nervous. I remember I had this professor at Columbia who said to me, if you don't feel a little nervous every time you cross the threshold of the classroom, it's probably time to think about retirement. And honey, we ain't there yet." James nodded. "He called you honey?" Jay laughed and gave him another hug. "You'll be swell, you'll be great," he sang in his best Ethel Merman voice as he exited. James smiled. Jay had always been there for him. Fran, meanwhile, was nowhere to be seen. He tried calling one more time. Still no answer. They'd originally planned on going uptown together, but that afternoon Fran texted he had to work late and would meet him at the Y instead. Now, minutes before the reading, he sent a message that the 7 train was delayed. So which was it? Too much work or subway trouble? Why not jump into a taxi or call an Uber? It didn't take a PhD in English to see what was going on. Of course he loved Fran and wanted him to be happy, wanted to do what he could to make him happy if it were possible. But raising a child, the sacrifice, the expense, the headache and heartache, he just couldn't fathom. The idea of being married wasn't even something he imagined for himself until a few years ago, much less being a parent. Maybe if he were younger, like Fran, he might feel different. But he was 54. He liked his life the way it was. His path, he believed, was set. He was already working on his next book, a series of personal and scholarly essays on place, from the house he grew up in to the home he'd made with Fran, along with some famous attics, rooms, and houses, both real and fictional, in between. And he could dimly see 2 or 3 more writing projects on the horizon. He took a deep breath. People had come to hear him speak about American Scholar. Friends and colleagues and students and people he didn't even know. Getting tangled up in a marital spat was the last thing he wanted at this moment. He stood up, silenced his phone, and slipped it into his pocket. Now, with book, notepad, and lucky silver cross pen in hand, and feeling good nervous, as he'd said to Jay, he entered the lounge. Anyway, who knows, he thought. Maybe Fran will make it in time for the reception.
What's your involvement in the queer communities?
I was an AIDS activist in the late 80s and early 90s. I was involved in ACT UP. When I got a full-time job in academia, I transferred my activist energies into my work as a teacher and educator and as a writer. Several years ago, I joined an activist organization with my husband and quickly realized that I don't have the chops for street action anymore, like I did when I was in my 20s. I feel like my writing is an extension of what I did as a teacher. I feel like I'm participating in conversations with other queer folk in a way that I hope is beneficial to the community.
How do you use social media to promote your work?
I do the best I can. I use Facebook and Instagram as a platform for my work as a writer, not just promoting my work, but also putting things out there that interest me, things I've read, things I've seen. I rarely, almost never post pictures of myself. There's nothing in my social media about my personal life. I try to use it as a platform for my identity as a writer and as a creative person. Twitter, I haven't cracked that nut, but I'm trying.
What do you like to read?
I like to read all kinds of things. I've been reading mostly art history because I'm training to become a docent at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I read a wonderful biography of an 18th century woman artist named Adélaïde Labillegière. I was reading a book on Chinese gardens because one of the objects on my tour is going to be a Chinese garden installation in the Met. I like to read fiction. I'm always trying to catch up with classics that I haven't read. About 2 years ago, I decided I was going to read Ulysses by James Joyce cover to cover. I had started it in graduate school. I had gotten about halfway through, and then I didn't have time to finish it. And so I read it. So rewarding. I absolutely loved it. I didn't understand a third of it or more. I let it wash over me. I like biography, all kinds of things.
Do you have any words of wisdom to pass along to other queer writers?
Be patient with yourself. I had a long dry spell between my first and my second books. It was a period in which I reinvented myself as a writer because I had started writing memoir and quasi-academic stuff. Then I switched over to fiction, and that took a while. I would also say to try not to get too caught up in notions of success. One of the things that interested me in graduate school was to learn about authors' reputations over time and how they fluctuated. And how writers that we consider great writers today, like Herman Melville, were seen as less than zero at certain points in their career. I feel like that's a healthy perspective to have because there is a lot of rejection in the life of an artist. It's hard to know, especially for a queer person, when that rejection is about you and when it's about something that has nothing to do with you, something that you can control versus something that you can't control. Trying to have a little distance from an obsession with success and how many books are sold and how many followers you have, that kind of thing. Read a lot, watch a lot of movies, look at a lot of art, expose yourself to what other people have to say. Try to write something every day. I start every day by writing in my diary. I have dozens and dozens of volumes now because I started it when I was 19. Sometimes I have to remind myself that this is a form of writing that I've been doing every day for so many years. It must have some impact on the published work. It's part of the process anyway.
I will say thank you, Patrick E. Horrigan.
Thank you so much, and thanks to everybody for tuning in.